Welcome to The Writing Life, the podcast for anyone who writes. I'm Steph McKenna, Senior Communications and Marketing Manager.
And I'm Holly Ainley, Head of Programmes and Creative Engagement.
And we're broadcasting to you from the National Centre for Writing at Dragon Hall in Norwich, UNESCO City of Literature. Hello, Holly Ainley.
Hello, Steph McKenna. Lovely to be chatting with you.
I'm very excited to be back after a little stint away from NCW and the podcast life. Yeah, it's a real joy to be back and to be hosting with you.
Absolutely. Well, I hope you'll improve of how we've been keeping the writing life home fires burning, but definitely glad to have you back.
I think you've been doing a brilliant job. So yes, I'm excited to be back on the podcast, and I'm also excited about our upcoming events that we've got at Dragon Hall, including a weekend of poetry and translation that we're hosting later this month in partnership with the Poetry Translation Centre. Holly, do you want to tell us more about that?
I can. Yeah, we are delighted to welcome the PTC, the Poetry Translation Centre, to Dragon Hall. They'll be joining us as part of a UK-wide tour celebrating their 20th birthday this year. We are first up to host them, and we have a whole weekend of events planned around the theme of exile and arrival. We have a workshop, we have panel discussions, and on the closing night, we have a polylingual open mic night, which is really exciting. This is all happening over the 21st, the 22nd, and the 23rd of March. So we kick off on the Thursday, the 21st, which is World Poetry Day. And as I say, we end with our polylingual open mic night on the 23rd. In between time, though, really exciting, Friday, the 22nd of March, is a fully hybrid event. And the title of the event is Voices in Exile. We're really excited because in Dragon Hall, we'll have two amazing translators, Elam Shakarifa and Maura Dooley. And we'll also have our host, George Surtees. They will be in conversation with one of Iran's leading poets, Azita Garaman, who's going to come to us live from Malmo in Sweden. So whilst we'll have our audience live in Dragon Hall, there's also an opportunity to tune in wherever you are in the world online, because we'll be streaming the whole thing. So really, really excited for that one and to be able to make it as accessible as possible internationally.
So if you're based near Norwich and you'd like to join us in person, you can pick up your tickets now for all of the events and the workshop from our website, nationalcentreforwriting.org.uk. And if you'd like to join us from elsewhere in the world for our live streamed event, you can book a space for free online via the website and we will email you a streaming link. And Holly, on the topic of translation, we were lucky to host some writers and translators from Singapore for a virtual residency between June and December last year, thanks to the generous support of the National Arts Council of Singapore.
We were indeed. They were the writers Nurel Hadar Jaffar, Wai Chu Sim, and Sehao Guang. And the three of them join us on this week's podcast, where they're in conversation with Daniel Hahn. Nurel Hadar Jaffar has translated children's picture books, fiction, and poetry since 2017, and is the author of 8 children's picture books. Wai Chu Sim's English translation of Singapore writer Ju Ming Chia's Sinophone novel, Exile or Pursuit, was published in 2019. And Sehao Guang is the author of 2 books, The International Left-Hand Calligraphy Association, great title, and Deeds of Light, the latter of which was shortlisted for the 2016 Singapore Literature Prize.
So together, our writers and translators discuss the quirks of being on a virtual residency, the individual projects that they were working on during those residencies, and the broader challenges and opportunities of life as a translator. Listeners can read the commissions that were produced from these virtual residencies by clicking on the link in the episode show notes.
It really is a fascinating conversation, and I hope everyone enjoys it as much as we did.
So now we will hand over to Daniel Hahn in conversation with Nurel Hadar Jaffar, Wai Chu Sim, and Sehao Guang.
My name is Daniel Hahn, and I'm delighted to be on the Writing Life podcast today, joined by three translators and writers from Singapore who've just completed their National Centre for Writing virtual residency June to December of last year, 2023. We're going to be talking about that experience, about what a virtual residency is, because it sounds like a slightly odd contradiction in terms. We're going to be talking about some of the work they did during that time and about the translating lives they have in Singapore. I'm also going to ask each of them, I think, to read a little bit from the work they did in their residency, because it'll be lovely to hear a bit from the work itself. Let's start with the very idea of a virtual residency. And I wonder if one of you, maybe Narel, I'll ask you to start here. For people who haven't encountered such a thing, what is a virtual residency, or what did you expect it to be?
I expected a lot of writing to be involved, as well as being able to meet translators and other practitioners and writers from other parts of the world. That's one of the things I expected. And we were informed that we'll be getting a mentor. So that's something that I have really enjoyed throughout my residency.
Thank you. I'll ask you all, I think, about working I'll ask you all about working with your mentors over the course of the residencies, because I think that's a really interesting component of it. But Hao Guang, tell us a bit about your expectations. Narel just said something about kind of meeting other writers, which I think is interesting. So it's not just a sort of isolated thing where you sit quietly on your own and do work. You're also part of a group.
Yeah. I guess, so I came in with hardly any expectations. I actually knew a couple of the previous e-residents, and so I had some sense of what was going to happen. But I really didn't know what to expect, because most of my residency experiences have been me leaving Singapore and like going to somewhere that is relatively isolated and meeting people there. So there was community as well in person. And so actually this was a rather unusual residency experience, in that a lot of times it was not a solitary experience at all. I was either living my normal life or having these online conversations. And I think that was ended up being quite useful and interesting to my writing, because my writing, it has a lot to do with internet, sort of collaging found internet text. And so I think that has sort of partially shaped the way that I worked over the course of this residency. So I found it quite interesting. And it was great to hear not just from, fellow residents, but also all the different guests, including yourself, that Kate brought in to meet with us.
Great, thank you. I'll ask you more about that. And actually, we'll be talking in a moment about the actual work you did, the found poetry you produced while you were working there. But Wei Chu, tell us about your expectations. It does sound like an interesting mix of what you would normally expect from a residency, in the sense that you have time to focus and you have a sort of community. But at the same time, you're still, I imagine, in your own home at the end of the day. You're still making your own food in your own kitchen.
Yeah.
It's a funny half-half, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I think if given a chance, I had a long stretch of holiday, I would have loved to come over and do a real-life residency. And then I can spend a bit of time in Norwich. I did my undergraduate in Norwich at the University of East Anglia, and I haven't been back since. This is decades. So I would have loved that. I have very fond memories of the place. But I think because of personal commitments, it wasn't possible. So we did it electronically. And I didn't know what to expect. The writing projects that they gave to us, I quite enjoy them. And I think in retrospect, one of them was to write something about some top tips for translation. And then I've enjoyed that quite a bit. The last one was a kind of commission about translation life. I wrote about what translation life might involve. I quite enjoyed just thinking about the issue and putting it into words. But there was one creative writing, one commission, which was a bit supposed to be something that's related to Norwich. And because I'm not there, I didn't know what to write about. So I decided that I would pretend that I'm translating a short story that someone had written, and I just put at the top there translation from XYZ, and then I would just be writing a short story. So it turned out to become a short story about someone who had a Singaporean guy following the main writer that I'm working on, who had fought in the Malayan emergency, and then he met this British guy there when he was there. The guy is an offspring of a planter, someone who owns a plantation in Malaysia during the emergency. So this guy wanders into the Malaysian rainforest to look for honey, and so he bumps into this Singaporean guy who's fighting in this insurgency. They are basically class enemies, but it doesn't turn into violence. So the guy with the gun allows the British guy to go back home, and then many years later they link up, and this guy is someone who comes from Norwich, and they develop a friendship. So after several years of that guy visiting this Singapore guy in Singapore, he's coming to Norwich for the first time. So that's how I worked into that story, a little bit of Norwich connections. But I just enjoyed doing the creative writing bit. It's been years since I did a bit of creative writing, so I enjoyed quite a bit of that too.
That's really nice to hear. And also that kind of that way of creating a sort of pretend translation of something. Well, I hope we will get you back to three-dimensional Norwich before too long. But in the meantime, it's interesting to hear about these experiences you've had. I'm glad also, Weiqi, that you mentioned the top tips for translation that you did, that you all, I think, wrote for NCW, which are available online. And there was some really interesting stuff there that I hope we might get to chat about a little bit as well. Let's talk a little bit about the particular projects that you were working on as part of your residency. Narelle, you were translating poetry. You were translating poetry. Tell us a little bit about the work that you were translating while you were there.
Oh, I'm translating Gandhura, which is a collection of poems by this by a woman by the name of Hatina Ahmad. She was born in the 1950s, and Gandhura won the Singapore Literature Prize, and it has collection. It has a few poems that she wrote when she was traveling around the world, and I chose this particular anthology of this particular writer to translate, because in Singapore, I think what I've seen is that there are more male writers, Malay writers, whose works have been translated compared to women writers. So my priority then was I must select a woman writer, and she gave different perspectives towards themes that have been highlighted by male writers, giving and showing them from a different lens. So there's a kind of there's a difference in her approach, and I decided that I'd like to give it a try. And especially since I've not been translating poetry as much as I've been translating other genres, especially children's books.
Tell us a bit about the particular challenges of this poetry, though. I think when we talked before, you were talking about there being sometimes more than one voice, sometimes more than one form. What are the things that make it a challenge to translate?
Oh, there's one poem in particular. It's about, I think the title is Nenek dan Kelip, Kelip Kelip di Pasir Panjang, which translates to Grandmother and the Fireflies at Pasir Panjang. Pasir Panjang is, I think it's on the western, it's the western coastline of Singapore. And it went through quite a bit of development for quite some time. So it is a lamentation of this grandmother about how the coast has changed, and she could no longer see the fireflies. The mangrove swamps were no longer there, right? And how she reminisced about how she met her husband, who was a master fisherman, and how they had satay by the beach in the afternoon. So that whole, that within that poem, I have two voices, the grandmother, and I assume it will be the granddaughter. I take the female narrator as default for all her, for all her poem, unless she specified that it is the man. And so it starts with the granddaughter, and then when it came to the grandmother, reminiscing about Pasir Panjang, it's a whole, it's actually prose poem. It's a paragraph of run-on lines. And then after that, the grandmother sang a song, but it's just the title was given. And then the grandmother recited a pantun, which is the highly regulated poetry in Malay. And then the granddaughter followed suit. And then the granddaughter first came up with, her voice was like very confident, you know, pro-development, you know, don't talk about the past. And then after that, the something happened and the granddaughter's voice changed to one of remorse. So so that's one, you know, I have to translate three different forms. And then I have to make sure that the different voices come through. So that's one, all the challenges encapsulated within one poem. And then there's another poem where she talks about, again, about loss, but this one about loss of culture, how young, the younger generation are not in, may not be fully supportive of the traditional arts, right? And in this instance, the art of playing music, of the hand drum on the kompang. And again, there's one whole line in Malay and in Javanese about the different ways of hitting the kompang. And at that point that I was like stuck, you know, like how am I going to translate those steps? And when I asked, I did my research, I spoke to two people who played the kompang and who were instructors, and they said there's no English equivalent, you know. And I asked one person, say, oh, we just teach them as beat number one, number two, number three. They cannot, they said, I can't do that. So yeah, it's something that I'll be discussing with my mentor.
Thank you. That the thing you said at the beginning, Narelle, about the poem between the grandmother and the granddaughter, and that the kind of the assumption you made, the default for you is going to be that it's a grand, the narrator's going to be a granddaughter, and that presumably that means that this is partly to do with the language itself, that Malay presumably does not reveal, in the language, does not reveal the gender of the narrator. So you have the option, essentially, of choosing whether this is going to be a granddaughter or a grandson when you're making your choice about how to translate it.
Yes, yes, yeah. But I'm not sure whether if I were to accept that narrator, take that narrator as a grandson, I'm not sure whether that would have changed the way I translate, you know, whether I would have chosen different, but I don't think that would make much of a difference. But I just chose to have the narrator, the default narrator, to be a woman.
Thank you. It's really interesting. I ask partly because I translate from Romance languages, which are very gendered in ways that it's almost impossible not to specify in the things that I'm translating, and so I often there's quite a lot of kind of rigidity to the text I'm dealing with. I don't have the possibility of reading in more than one way. That's really interesting. Hao Guang, tell us about that. You were not translating, or at least not exactly translating. I think we should come to the relationship between what you're doing and translation a little later. But tell us about this. You mentioned when we started talking a few minutes ago that this is sort of found poetry. Tell us what you were working on.
Yeah, so this is a project that started before the residency, but it has sort of like accumulated many more poems since. And what I do is I have been very interested in the language that is being that continues to be used, and has been used for at least perhaps two decades by now, in Singapore and Malaysian internet forums, particularly those that are sort of tech-based, that started out life as a way for people to find out which is the best mobile phone to buy, or like which laptops are the fastest for gaming. And they've developed their own sort of like idiolect. They use language in really inventive ways, multilingual, and also sort of ferociously poking fun at each other and at current affairs. And I've been collaging found text from these forums and writing poems out of that. And I think, I guess what I would say is that I found it quite interesting that because there are two main forums I'm looking at, one Malaysian and one Singaporean, and besides the language, the sort of mechanics of the forums also sort of shape the way that I write. I might have mentioned this before, actually, but for example, in the Malaysian forum, it's that there are less posts, and it's also an easier sort of they categorize the posts more easily. So I can sort of go to the earliest post in the entire forum, and then sort of click through and discover interesting posts along the way. But I can't do that for the Singapore forum, and so I have to learn how to use like the search function, and search for specific keywords, and then sort of like click through into old posts. So that has also sort of, I think, shaped the way that these poems take form. Like the Malaysian ones are a little bit more random, things that I might not have expected I would be searching for, but the Singapore ones are pretty sort of focused, and are guided by what I think I want to search for. And for example, I wanted to find a Norwich connection, so I typed Norwich into the Singapore forum search bar and wondered what come out. And of course, it was football, so all these threads about like Norwich City and whether Manchester United is good enough to beat Norwich City because it's so shit now or whatever, that sort of thing. So that was what I found. I found it really interesting.
When you started saying that, I was wondering if you'd be the first person who'd ever searched for Norwich on one of those forums, but apparently not. Apparently Norwich City has a significant role to play. When you said how the language that you're dealing with, the language that's being used on these fora is... You used, I think, the word multilingual. We're not just talking about, as it were, Singlish. It's something that has a number of different languages built into it.
Yeah, that's right. I think so. Singlish, in the first place, is a little bit multilingual. It draws from all the many languages that people in Singapore speak. But it also includes a fair number of Southeast Asian influences. So there's a significant Filipino presence in these forums as well. And that has led to some sort of ugly racial incidents where people are accusing the moderators of being like too friendly to the Filipinos and saying, "Are you actually Filipino? Like, we don't want you here. Like, can you form your own forum?" That sort of thing. And also there's a thread that is all about Thai discos. And so there are a bunch of Singaporean men who frequent these discos and have picked up Thai in order to communicate with the girls there. And so they start speaking this sort of like broken Thai to each other on the forums. So there's a very interesting sort of linguistic diversity that I feel exceeds even that of like typical spoken Singlish that you might hear like in the street. And they invent their own sort of like their own terms, their own short forms, their own acronyms. And so it's all this like this whole mix of things, which I think even an ordinary Singaporean might sometimes find sort of alienating, and to me that is sort of fascinating as well.
I wonder, Weichu, thinking about Singapore, not just these forums, but Singapore also more broadly as this multilingual society in a place where people have relationships with more than one language, but also the sort of blurring of these languages into each other, because English is not the same depending on what it's coexisting with, right? So we mentioned Singlish, but also English varies wherever you are. And I wonder then, Weichu, what the implications are for a translator of this, of working in a sort of cross-pollinating multilingual society. I mean, historically, Europe, there's been a lot of this in Europe as well, historically. But I wonder, as a translator, what the implications are of working in a society where that is, where the English that you're translating into is coexisting in this very particular way with these other languages.
I think it's tough because English is already localized in Singapore. So in Singapore, we call it Singlish. We might have Indian words in it, Malay words in it, And then the sentence structure might follow the vernacular rather than English. And then in Malaysia, they call it Manglish. So we already have that, but that dichotomy and difference is already built into it. So I think, like, for people who use Singlish or are from a Chinese background, my understanding is that would be different from people who use Singlish from a Malay background. Already, they have their own subset of that localized language. So with more of these Southeast Asia people coming in and they've made it their home, I mean, we can tell, like, I can go to this mall and that will be little Laos, and that particular mall will be little Thailand, and another one will be little Manila. We can tell, you know, where are the places where the different... It's becoming a bit of a HQ, a kind of capital for Southeast Asia. So at some level, I suspect the little subgroups will also build up their own vernacular of English, Singlish. Because English is the main lingua franca, it's the language of communication, language of instruction when you work. So it will continue to be the main language, but all these different languages that are there will come into the little subsets of localized English that we use. And I think maybe you can't escape that. You can't escape that. You just have to be out there in contact with people and do your research. Like Narelle mentioned, you know, she talks to people who know how to play the kompang. You have to do your research and be willing to, I guess, just be willing to be flexible. And then there's always the issue of are we translating for a British or an American audience, the where the market is for English language writing, or are we translating for a much smaller Southeast Asian English reading audience? So that's an issue that maybe there isn't a real answer to that. It depends on who's your publisher and where the publisher is going to distribute that particular work. These are all the permutations that you might get, I think.
I just wanted to say that I feel that very much for my writing as well, especially these poems that I'm writing. Like, I feel I've tried submitting them to some like places, but they've all mostly been rejected so far, and I can see why. And the question is, like, who am I writing for? It's a big question.
I wonder how much that changed in the residency process. I remember you saying something about having a sense of one audience when you were writing, and then starting to work with Tiffany, your mentor, and having a different first reader in mind. Whether that forces you to think differently about who your reader is.
Yeah, I felt that. So I think I was a bit mischievous in that I felt Tiffany was a little bit of a captive audience. And so I thought, okay, this is a great way to sort of just give her an unfiltered, like, just all the stuff I had already been doing. And let's just see what she thought of it. And to her great credit, she was so, like, really willing to play along and came at it with a very interesting sort of, a very specific sort of an open mind, which is, I am willing to be confronted with things I have no idea about. But at the same time, I also want to give... she also gave comments based on where she came from. So she's not saying things like, oh, just do whatever you want, right? Anyway, she was giving specific sort of interventions based on things like where she got lost and whether she was happy getting lost in those places and whether she was not happy getting lost and why. And so I thought that was really interesting, a very fascinating way to sort of like approach these poems from the vantage point of somebody who, you know, has not really lived in Singapore or doesn't understand what Singlish is in the first place and then is confronted with all these extra like mysterious things. I feel like she got it. And that gave me some confidence then to start submitting these things to journals. But it seems like so far she's the only one who gets it.
I wonder, Narelle, the thing you said before about a sort of loss of culture in some young people, whether there is a connection between that and this question of whom you're translating for. And on the one hand, there's the possibility of thinking about, you know, young Malays in Singapore who might read something in English that might connect them to their culture. But again, doing a residency, a virtual residency in Norwich with a different mentor and with potentially different readership makes you think slightly differently about who your readers might be or whom you would like your readers to be.
Yeah. Yes, in the beginning, so, I'm going to translate to the English reader, right? And then I discuss it with things like, do I translate seluar as pants or trousers? If I were to write for the Americans, then if I were to write for the British reader, then which is the proper word? Things like that. But then and Shesh really helped me a lot with refining my translation about how people who read English poetry, the kind of English, the way English poems are written, I guess, but it's not a rigid thing. But she gave me the things that she shared with me remind me to read more. But one thing that developed as I went through my residency is that when I read Hartina's poems and I translate, there's a greater appreciation of the events, the circumstances, the changes, the transformation that she wrote in her poem, in her poems, and I realized that these things need to be translated into English, not just to have an international audience know more about Malay literature, know more about Singapore Malay literature and the Singapore Malay community, but it is so important for Singaporeans to know of Hartina and the things that she writes in her poems. And it's not just about the loss, the transformation, the loss of culture, the things that we lost along the way as Singapore developed into this global power, I won't say superpower, but this global presence, right? But it's also, she has poems about independence, the nation as an independent country, but also about, there are a few poems talk about a woman claiming her independence, claiming her place in the world. So I felt that these poems should be read, should be made available for more Singaporeans out there, especially for the Malays who are reading more in English. And especially the concern is that more Malays are speaking in English, they're reading less in Malay, and the transfer of cultural wisdom, the transfer of heritage, knowledge of heritage, I think it is much better done within the Malay language itself, right? There's one example, it's not connected to language, it's about how developments we can make people lose something within the cultural practices. For the Malay community, with Malay gatherings, right, we would tend to roll out the long mats and sit down and have a communal feast within families. But because Singapore's flats are getting smaller and smaller, there is less opportunity for that to happen, for big gatherings within family to come over and then spread the mat and everybody eats together. And even wedding feasts are now buffets compared to previously we serve in trays and you eat four people by four people, right? So the words that are connected to those kind of practices are now less spoken. And then you have the loss of the loss of words being used within the community then. So if I can translate things like that as Hartina had written them, included them in her poem, somebody reads them in English, they may be interested to know more about it, and especially a Malay person, we're more interested and find out more about the other aspects connected to their culture in Malay.
The things that are revealed by which bits of language or which bits of vocabulary are used less and less is fascinating, I think. It's something which we've seen in English here in the UK, that there's a kind of generational shift in which words young people know to do with the natural world, particularly compared to a couple of generations ago. It's words for plants and trees and things that are out in the natural world that are sort of disappearing generationally, and what that sort of tells us. Would you tell us briefly what it was you're working on in the residency, but also read us a little bit from it? I'd like to hear some of that work.
So are you asking to read from the original or from the translated bit?
I'd like to hear your translation, if we can, please. But tell us a bit what it is. I mean,
it's a collection of short stories by a guy called Hai Fan. It was published a couple of years back, and he spent 13 years as a participant in the second Malayan emergency. He was an insurgent. So basically, they lost, and after the 1989 Hat Yai peace agreement. There was an agreement signed between Thailand, Malaysia, and the Malayan Communist Party. This was the party that had launched the insurgent. They laid down arms and they came back. Some of them stayed on in the peace villages that were built. Then two peace villages, I think, built in Thailand. And then the others went back to their countries, etc. So he was one of those after 13 years who laid down arms. And he's just writing about the experience. I think the good thing about it is that there's no attempt to just like spend all this time trying to justify socialism against all comers, for instance, right? He's just trying to write about the ecological experience of being, for modern people, of spending so much time in a rainforest and how beautiful it is. He's trying to re-aestheticize the rainforest. You know, in some sense, we have lost contact with nature. And I think the wonderful experience that he's trying to put together is a contact that they have. So this is a bit where he's writing one of the short stories about him, the protagonist is out with one of the indigenous tribes, and they're both hunting for food, and there's a deer that's caught in one of the traps. It's a barking deer. These are manjaks, which are barking deers. They're also called rib-faced deers. They are native to Southeast Asia. So the amazing thing is that the deer manages to break out of the trap. I'll just read from this little section that I've prepared. Manjaks were docile ruminants. They were herbivores. Kerting knew that catching this one alive shouldn't be a problem. In all likelihood, they would have venison fried with wild ginger when they returned to camp that evening, together with a cauldron full of nutrient-rich deer blood soup. And what was more, the manjak was in the prime of life. Its pelt was bright brown yellow with a glossy patina. New antler buds were forming at the top of his head. Filled with excitement, Kerting unshouldered his rucksack and opened it. From inside, he pulled out a coil of rope that he had prepared earlier. Suddenly, they heard a loud popping sound. In an instant, the manjak broke free. The sapling that provided the anchor point now pointed skywards and was no longer caught in an arc. It vibrated slightly in the air. A 10-meter stretch of the undergrowth went fala-fala as the animal dashed away. Then everything returned to its customary stillness. The gentle forest breeze, what they just witnessed, everything felt unreal and dreamlike. They checked the trap. The steel noose was still intact. It wasn't broken and still hung in its original position. Held tightly in its grip, however, was a 10-inch section of foreleg and deer hoof. Kerting had heard before that in extremis, certain creatures could break their legs and make good an escape. He didn't expect to witness it himself. He didn't expect that an animal as docile as the manjak could pull off such a trick. That's the extract.
Thank you very much, Weichu, for that. I wonder, when you were talking about the setting of these stories and the way they're about kind of the valuing the aesthetic of the rainforest and so forth, whether you feel they're also potentially part of the conversation that we're all having now, the sort of ecological conversation we're having.
Yes, I think definitely. I think it puts local writing right at the forefront of the ecological crisis. To the extent that we are living, I think there's no denial, we are living in an era of a global ecological overshoot. We're using too much of the resources, and the ability of the ecosystem to regenerate is not enough to keep up with that ecological overshoot. So this little short story, for instance, this guy who's amazed that this animal can escape from a trap. Later on, he wants to run after it and catch it, but the indigenous indigenous hunter who's with him says, "No, we shouldn't." Right? That animals have an ability to fight back beyond a certain level, and to us it sounds like just mythology. But he's actually taking the time and making the effort to share with us to what extent some of these myths and stories that we have from some of these indigenous people. These are actually a way to keep the forest sustainable, right? To what extent these stories help us to keep forests sustainable, and they've been doing it for thousands of years. So when indigenous people tell modern people, they tell us that our past is your future, that at some level you have to learn how to live within the confines without moving into ecological overshoot. So all this is very relevant. We hear stories about bushfire in Australia or floods all over the place in Southeast Asia. I think we are living in an era now, and it's all got to do with also the way in which modernity turns us into consumers. And Norell was talking about the loss of culture. So modern culture turns us into consumers, and we don't have a way to keep our desires in check, I suppose. So that we can avoid ecological overshoot. So I think all this literature is useful. I'm just very happy that I get a chance to share it and hopefully bring it out to a wider audience.
Well, talking about modern culture turning us into consumers, we're going to talk about online tech forums now. And I wonder whether you can say something about the process of making the fan poems. I'm going to ask you to read in just a moment. But it strikes me as interesting that all of you in different ways are sometimes translating as well as writing. And it strikes me how that there are ways in which kind of collaging a poem with found material has something of the translation about it. It's not only you're not, as it were, writing just on a blank page. So can you say something about that process of making this thing that is yours but is also... It was starting with the words of other people.
Yeah, I think I want to connect that with the e-residency experience, which is, like I said, instead of sort of like being by yourself, being away, you're now like thrust into these either online interactions or the daily life that you ordinarily live. And I feel that that also sort of informed the way I was thinking about writing these poems. Typically, if I were writing just sort of like non-collage poems, right, I would prefer to be disconnected from the internet if I were writing on a laptop, or at the most sort of like writing on pen and paper, right? But these poems force me to be hyper-connected, sort of doom-scrolling sometimes, like constantly clicking, you know, like forums have like page 1 to 10 and you just have to keep clicking to the next page to find more comments. And so I had the presence of these voices constantly with me. And it sort of weirdly reminded me of moments where I had done some translating of my own and you know, paying such close attention to the words of other people. Sort of, I don't know, Norella, why Chu, like what you think about this, but like you hear the words of the writers that you're translating in your head. And even when you've stopped looking at the text, you sort of like, think about what they say, how they say it, and that sort of thing. And so I've been living with these voices in my head. And these voices obviously are not just one person, they're many people. And they say all kinds of like sometimes terrible and offensive things, right? So it was that sort of experience. Then trying to see what was exciting or what was most exciting about those voices and sort of plucking them out of context a little bit, arranging them. Trying for a good balance of sort of what would be true to the text, but also or true to what they said, but also intelligible for the reader. And that process also felt a lot like the translation process in terms of things like how do you, to what extent do you translate certain specialized terms, like what Narelle was saying, and to what extent do you just leave them untranslated, perhaps, for the audience to just contextually pick up.
I wonder, Narelle, as someone who translates and writes also, how these things feed each other for you. How was talking about, you know, hearing the voices of the people you are translating, and that obviously feeds the translation you're producing. But are your translating and writing, especially if you're doing, you know, children's stories both times, for example, from a craft point of view, even, do those two things feed each other?
Sometimes when I write, my characters speak in English and then I have to translate it back into Malay. But it also shows how I'm so used to thinking in English now. And it's okay. I could cope with it.
No, it's interesting. I mean, I know it can be quite a difficult thing to conceptualize somehow, particularly if you're doing these things all the time and the languages are kind of operating all the time as well. That's very interesting. Hal, would you read a little bit from one of the poems that you were working on at the residency?
Sure. In fact, I will read the football poem, which is, I should say that it's a poem that where everyone is making fun of Manchester United. And the pet name for Man U in this poem is Manure. That's the name that they give to Manchester United. So I apologize to anyone who's hearing this and has like strong feelings about this. Let's laugh at manure. That's the title. For everyone in EPL football forum to relax one corner and to curse Wayne Rooney deep, to kena langa by Laurie so he will be injured for life. Then so manure will fulfill the Liverpool fans' dream of never winning another Premiership title. Manure fan here came in to plus one Nia Song Song. Don't worry, Man United will still win the next 37 matches. Loser kia, jin xia sui. Team lose liao wanna ham tam people, go take sleeping pills and go kun la. At gangster nia. Got balls, put your location, I will drive down to your place and we settle. See those manure fans flame Liverpool yesterday. See that Jin Bui Song. The ball is round. What goes around comes around. During the start of the season, Man U lose. Damn happy and laugh damn hard. Now, I know feeling. Perhaps look down at the table, can't see them. Can Moist give Norwich 3 points so they can survive? I laugh at the claim of winning treble. Ha 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 ha. Gonna win treble. I laugh at the claim to getting in top four. Ha 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 ha. Gonna get in top four. Don't fret, Manure is still ahead of Liverpool on goal difference. Their pep talk before match and halftime is, guys, you all only got two options. A, you screwed the opposition. B, I screwed your wife. Choose one. David Moyes set to be sacked by Manchester United. No, please give him more time. Please, 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 tolong. Wah Liu, Jin said, hope they appoint another cock-up to make us happy. Don't worry, can still laugh at Ryan Giggs. This threat shall live on. Song Bo Manure. Norwich also can't win. Well, if it's not because of the controversies from the refs, from this and that, I think football is boring. Totally. You've got nothing to talk about every week in, week out. Oh, Liverpool won. Oh, Chelsea lost again. That's all we're going to be reacting. If it wasn't for all these wrong decisions, we can't debate, we can't argue, we can't spectaculate. Whatever. For now, glory, glory, Norwich City.
Amazing. Thank you so much. Wait, Chiu, I was thinking when I was reading about the thing you were saying about English as a thing that varies in kind of quite small pockets, quite particular pockets, and depending on the community, it will vary from place to place. And thinking about how a poem like the one we've just heard might or might not be translated into any other language, because so much of what creates the effect is not just the multiplicity of voices, but also the way in which those things are textured by what you might consider different languages. In fact, they blur into this thing. But I wonder whether, as a translator, Wei Chiu, you hear something that kind of moves between languages like that. And that sounds like it will be a joy for a translator to grapple with, or whether it sounds like an absolute impossible nightmare.
I think it's very hard. If you have two languages in a text, let's say A and B, does that mean that when you translate into translate this text, it has to be into two languages as well, into C and D? So, but what if you don't really know, what if you want to translate into what most of the language is, let's say A and there's a little bit of B, let's say a Chinese dialect or Chinese Mandarin that's in this English focused text, and you try to translate it into Mandarin, then what do you do with the Mandarin bits? So do you need to translate in two languages or one language? There are all kinds of tactical and strategic decisions to be made. I think it's really tough. I suspect it might work better as a kind of performance art. Does that make sense? I mean, what do people think? I mean, does it that when you translate, let's say an English text that has a bit of the vernacular in it, it can be vernacular Chinese or Malay, and then when you translate it, let's say into the minority language in that text, are there issues in terms of what strategy to use?
I wonder what you think about this. I deliberately did not ask you this question first, but I wonder how you feel about the things that you're writing as the potential source for other things, as things that might be translated or might change their center of gravity somehow, moving from language to language. Yeah.
I would hate to translate this, I think. But I think part of the... So when Waju was talking, I think there's also there's clearly a class aspect to this thing, right? This is the language of what people would say is a lower class, right? It's a lower class pitch. And whether it's something that's put on, so some people feel that these forum people are actually pretending to speak this way. Whether it's put on or whether it's genuine, there's a class aspect to it. And I think that could be translatable in any language that has different sort of like registers or different class sort of class markers, right? And so like a mix of, for example, French and Creole, I think that's one like possibility. Or different kinds of Englishes, like quote unquote standard US English and maybe like African American vernacular, like something like that. I think that could be a way to do it. But it would be really challenging, I think. And then the question is what value is gained by translating these things? And I feel that it's something that needs a lot of thought. Can't just like, you know, dive in and do it without thinking and expect to get something useful out of it. Yeah.
I'm going to end by asking Nurel to read a little something to us. Nurel, in the top tips for translators that you wrote for the NCW website, you talked about reading aloud. I think when you're writing about translating picture books, you talked about reading aloud as a way of kind of testing whether a translation is working. So I'm going to ask you to read a bit from one of the poems that you worked on. But maybe before that, can you just tell us something about the title of this poem? Because I think it relates a little bit to some of the conversations we were having earlier.
Yes, okay, let me look for somewhere. I lost the page. Yes, the title of this poem is just Karungguni. Literally it means gunny sack. And it's the term used in Singapore to refer to the rag and bone man. People who go on collecting discarded items or unused items in the house, and then you pay a certain amount to the previous owner, right? I'm not sure how it is over there in England, but I remember the last, when we used to subscribe to newspapers like this stack, this high stack, and then they'd be going around saying, Karungguni, Karungguni, you know, on the ground floor. And then from the 10th floor, you can just shout, "Karangoni!" And then he just called back and say, "Mau apa, mau jual apa, what are you selling?" You know? And then we just shout like, "Newspaper, surat kepada dan hukum." Right? That was like, but that was like my childhood. But nowadays, you go down to the Karangoni, they ask you, you know, say like, "Do you accept phones, handphones?" Yeah, they accept handphones. And then they ask you, "What model?" "What model number?" I said, "Do you accept MacBook? Do you accept Mac? What model?" You know, and that kind of thing. So it has evolved, but you see less and less of them now.
Yeah, it's a very different market that they're operating, Ragged Bone Man now.
Yeah, and I used to like the horn, the when we would rush out for that. But nowadays, I don't hear that much. You can just call them and say, "Come and collect my stuff." Yeah.
Would you read a little for us, Narelle? I'd love to hear it.
So anyway, I just like to add that we were wondering. I was wondering, how do I translate Karangoni? You know, I can't use the word gunny sack, right? I thought, should I just change it to, do I translate to the Vagrant Moon Man? And I spoke with my mentor, and then we decided, let's slip in the original term somewhere inside the poem, and find another way to indicate what is the story in this poem all about. So instead of Karangoni, I change it to something else and not Rag and Bone Man. So here goes. I'm just going to read some excerpts of it. "All newspapers, the call echoes on Sunday morning from the lowest floor, loud and clear, disturbing the resident's slumber. All newspapers, the Karangoni man hawks his voice in a country of number ones, whose citizens easily tire of people and things, furniture, televisions, computers, books, clothes, blankets, newspapers. He will pick up anything, everything, before they get thrown away everywhere. $1,000 fine awaits. All newspapers." His voice cascades down the building, rousing residents from their sleep on that bright Sunday morning. The Karangoni man goes up and down to provide for his wife and child. A day will come when his voice will not be heard again.
Well, it's been such a pleasure talking to you all. I'm afraid we are. That went faster than I expected. We are already a little bit over time. But thank you for sharing your experiences at the residency. Thank you for sharing, for talking about your work and for reading a little to us. It's been great hearing from you. And thank you to anyone who's listening. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
A big thank you to Narelle Huda-Jaffar, Sim Wai Chu, and Sei Hao Guang. And of course, to our host, Daniel Hahn. And thank you to you for listening. Don't forget, you can read all the commissions by our Singaporean writers and translators via the link we've put in the show notes. If you have any questions for us or you want to get in touch, you can find us at Writers Centre on Twitter and Instagram. We're on Facebook, and you can sign up to the NCW newsletter at nationalcentreforwriting.org.uk.
We're also scheduling our first mailbag episode in a few weeks.
Yes, can't wait for that.
It's going to be exciting. So if you have any pressing questions for us about NCW, about the podcast, about the craft of writing, or anything else you fancy, do drop us an email at info@nationalcentreforwriting.org.uk.
As a UK registered charity, we rely on the generosity of our supporters to make our work possible. To find out more about what we do and how you can make a donation, check out our website on the Support Us page.
And if you enjoyed what you heard today, please do consider subscribing to the podcast and leaving a rating and a review, because this helps other writers to find us. Thanks again, keep writing, and we'll catch you on the next episode.